Good morning. It's a nice crowd today. Before we get started, I, on behalf of the court, would briefly like to recognize Senior Judge Robinson Everett, who passed away on June 12th. Judge Everett was involved with this court from his earliest days. He was a chief judge for 10 years, and he remained active in both court activities and in military justice until his death. In fact, he was scheduled to sit on these two cases that we have today. Robbie was an inspiration to all who knew him in both his personal and his professional life. Please join me in a moment of silence to honor his memory. Thank you. The court will be holding a formal memorial session for Judge Everett at a later time. Sitting today on the court are two former chief judges of this court, Senior Judge Walter Cox and Senior Judge Sparky Gerke. We are also pleased to welcome Judge Joe Goodwin, Chief Judge of the United States District Court for the Southern District of West Virginia, who is sitting by designation of the Chief Justice of the United States. At this time, we'll call United States versus Ashby.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Lieutenant Dylan Ambrose, counsel for the appellant in this case, Captain Richard J. Ashby, United States Marine Corps. Appellant will first address the legal insufficiency arguments, then we'll move on to accuser and UCI type issues, post-trial delay, and any other issues that this court may direct me to. The facts of this case were highly publicized. The pertinent facts of this specific court-martial revolve around a videotape. A videotape that the government admits, at page 5 of its brief, did not have any footage of the mishap during this flight. Question for this court is whether appellant conspired to obstruct justice with Captain Schweitzer, and whether he obstructed justice by removing that videotape, by secreting that videotape, and by destroying that videotape at the hands of Captain Schweitzer. The military members were correctly informed about the elements of this crime. Under this crime, they needed to find that Captain Ashby wrongfully did an act. In this case, removal of the videotape, secreting of the videotape, and destroying of the videotape. Second, they had to find when he had reason to believe there were or would be criminal proceedings. Third,
are the elements under 134 relevant to 133 prosecution?
In this case, yes, Your Honor.
How so?
Well, they were put on notice that they were going to be charged under this obstruction of justice charge. The military members were instructed that those were the elements that they needed to find. And that's what they defended against. That's what the defense team defended against. The next element that needs to be proven is that the act was done with intent to impede the due administration of justice. So there actually has to be an intent to impede this administration of justice. Now, the military judge correctly informed the members that administrative acts are not to be considered a criminal proceeding.
Therefore, Counsel, yes, Your Honor. In your brief, you note that at the time of the offense, he did not have a subjective belief that there was going to be a criminal investigation. But the specification charges from, I believe, 3 February to 14 March. And so don't we look at that entire period, which includes the period of time after which he was informed by the Italian magistrate that he was subject to an Italian criminal inquiry?
Yes, Your Honor, we do look at that. We look at that full period of specification. And that goes to the expansion of what is a criminal proceeding. The military.
Well, apart from your issue, too, which is whether it's an Italian criminal proceeding, why would not he have a subjective belief if he was told by the Italian magistrate, and just assuming for that question, that a foreign criminal proceeding is included within obstruction of justice under the UCMJ, why would that not give him a subjective belief?
Well, I believe he did have a subjective belief. I think we would concede that he had a subjective belief that a criminal investigation, when it comes to an Italian investigation, was occurring. He testified to that. Captain Schweitzer testified to that, that they knew that a criminal investigation was going on shortly after they came back from their flight.
So this issue is dependent then upon your second issue.
I think the fact that they're coupled together, it does make a difference because the members were given two alternative theories upon which to convict an appellant in this case. They were given the theory that they could find that a military criminal proceeding occurred, or he believed one would occur, and they were given the theory that an Italian criminal proceeding was occurring or would occur. If one of those is impermissible, impermissible. The court's case in Sendejas, I think it rules here, and because the members were given two alternative theories, and if one is impermissible, then this needs to be set aside. So I don't think it necessarily, I don't think the first issue matters as much. The fact that they were the members were given two alternative theories is what matters.
Well, before the tape was destroyed, they knew there were 20 dead people.
Yes,
correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. And you're a member of the armed forces subject to the Uniform Code?
Yes, sir.
And it's an official duty case under the NATO SOFA?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Now, how could any belief that there would be no UCMJ action be reasonable with those under those circumstances?
Well, Your Honor, I think the fact that Captain Ashton was acquitted his first trial for those actions, alleging that he was at fault in this flight, bears on this case. He had no reason to believe that a criminal action would occur because he did not believe he was at fault. Nobody would have believed that they were at fault. The fact that there were the actual
officers, it doesn't go to whether he was acquitted. It goes to whether he could reasonably believe that nothing was pending or would be pending under the UCMJ.
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And I think I don't think there is evidence that he would have believed that. Matter of fact, Captain Schweitzer,
20 dead people in a NATO sofa, and he wouldn't have believed that?
It was a horrible tragedy, Your Honor. There's no doubt about that. But the fact is that they believed that they would be exonerated through the CIB process because of the fact that they did not do anything wrong.
But that doesn't go – exoneration through the CID process doesn't cut the mustard for obstruction of justice. Well, if they're reasonable to believe that there was going to be some sort of UCMJ criminal proceeding, that cinches it, doesn't it?
Well, I don't think so in this case because of the fact that we also were given that – the members were also given that alternative theory of foreign criminal jurisdiction. So
well, we're not getting to that yet. You know, I'm not getting to Sendejas. I'm getting to the code.
Yes, I don't believe they would have known in that case. I won't concede that. But if they would have conceded or if they would have believed that, yes, that would be a case in which they could be found guilty. But that was not the case here. And I don't think subjectively that's reasonable because Captain Schweitzer, Captain Ashby, none of these members, they knew that a CIB was occurring. And they didn't expect or get criminal charges until after they got back to Cherry Point, back to the United States.
So, in other words, they reasonably believed that 20 dead people would only result in a safety board.
Yes, Your Honor. A CIB board that would exonerate them because they had not done anything wrong.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I have a little different area that wasn't briefed very well, if at all. Under the long line of cases dealing with conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman, beginning with Parker v. Levy. Now, Parker v. Levy talked about notice, didn't it? And you could draw notice from what sources? And from 134 would be notice under 133. Do you concede that?
They had notice of what charge was what they were defending against. Yes, they did.
Okay. So it doesn't have to be enumerated under 133 in line with the more modern cases from this court, which don't let you fairly embrace things from other. I don't know. I hadn't followed the jurisprudence of the court, but I understand some of the older cases where we could find a 134 offense, for example, as a lesser included of an enumerated offense has been struck down.
Your Honor, in this case, they were given notice of specific charges that they were to defend against.
But where did they get notice that their conduct was criminal?
From those charges, Your Honor.
I'm talking about at the day they destroyed the tape. Was there any case that said destruction of evidence is obstruction of justice?
No, Your Honor, not to my knowledge that there was no case at that point.
And didn't this tape belong to Captain Asbury himself?
It belonged to Captain Schweitzer, sir. Captain Schweitzer bought the videotapes and gave them to Captain Ashby to use.
Using his camera.
In his camera, okay. Yes, sir.
Well, if Captain Asbury had gone to the JAG and said, I want to destroy the tapes, is that okay? And you researched it, what case would you find that says destruction of evidence is obstruction of justice in the military?
I don't think you would find a case, depending on what his intent was.
Well, where would he get notice?
Get the notice.
I'm trying to help you.
I think you would get notice from what the charges were, what kind of...
Well, the charges
what,
are
what
after...
What kind of case law was out there.
The charges are after the fact.
Yes, Your Honor.
When you read Article 134, there's nothing in there talking about destruction of evidence. It's talking about by means of bribery, intimidation, misrepresentation, threat of force, delay in preventing. Where do we find anything that says spoliation of evidence that you own is criminal?
We don't find anything, sir.
If it weren't criminal, could it still be conduct unbecoming an officer?
I think it could be in certain circumstances, yes, if that's what's alleged and that's what's charged and that's what's defended against. But that's not the situation we had here. We had an alleged crime with certain charges, with certain elements that had to be met in this case, and that's what they defended against. Had they been given something different, had they been charged with something different, they may have defended it differently. But we have what the charges are in this case. And in this case, I believe that the foreign criminal proceedings went beyond the scope of what was they were charged with, what they were given intent of. Foreign criminal proceedings is beyond the scope of what an obstruction of justice is. Criminal proceedings...
Well, do you have any case law support for the proposition that foreign criminal proceedings aren't included?
I don't believe there is. The only case law out there that talks about specific to foreign criminal proceedings is an Army Board case, and that's an Army Court case, and that deals with Bailey. And Bailey, I think, is correct in one respect. Bailey gives deference to the quotes of Guerrero and United States versus Long, where the essence of the offense denounced is the obstruction or interference with the administration of justice administration of justice in the military system. That's from United States versus Long, and Guerrero copies that and says basically the same thing. The essence is military justice and whether that is frustrated. Bailey gets it right because what they do in that case is they tie it to military justice.
Right, and here you have two Marines flying a plane and killing 20 people, albeit accidentally, and an Italian inquiry with which U.S. investigative resources are intertwined. And that's not related under Bailey?
No, that's related to Bailey, and I think that's where Bailey gets it wrong, is that this conduit theory, which attempts to bring it back to military justice, military criminal procedure.
But there's no, you have no case law support for your assertion.
You know, Your Honor, I don't have case law, but there's the only case law that is out there is Bailey's Army Court case, and I think it can be distinguished, as well as I think it was wrongly decided.
Okay, and the NATO SOFA requires NATO members to cooperate with each other in FCJ cases.
That's correct.
And it gives primary jurisdiction to the United States in official duty cases. And there's a statute on the books in Title 10 dealing with bail and counsel fees for members of the armed forces in FCJ cases. And there's no relationship?
If that service member, Bailey in that Korean NATO situation was aware of that SOFA agreement and was aware of that conflict.
They're briefed on the SOFA, are they not?
I'm not aware if they are, Your Honor. They may be briefed on the SOFA, but that's not what.
Well, but is actual knowledge necessary, or is it they knew or should have known?
Well, intent is necessary. Intent to impede the due administration.
Right.
So
right.
If you only intend to impede this Korean investigation in Bailey, and you don't know that somehow that's going to affect the military criminal proceeding, that is not the intent to obstruct a military criminal proceeding.
What if you intended to obstruct a state court proceeding?
United States v. Smith deals with that specific issue, and I think Smith also relies upon that same language of bringing it back to a military criminal proceeding. The quote is, the impact of the charged conduct on a later, but nonetheless probable military investigation brought it within the intended scope of Article 134. Therefore, and Smith, what we had was a parallel military investigation that was going on.
But the obstruction was related to the state.
That's
action.
Correct. And in that situation, the theory was it was brought back to the military criminal proceeding because of the fact that they were investigating this as well. It was initially reported, I believe, to the military authority as a sexual assault of some sort.
Wasn't there a parallel investigation between the Italians and the military in this case?
Yes, Your Honor, there was. Under the Bailey, that's why Bailey can be distinguished. There was perhaps some interplay with some investigation. One investigation was a CIB investigation, though. It was administrative, and we can't use administrative proceedings under the scope of what is a criminal proceeding under obstruction of justice.
Weren't there counsel from outside Italian counsel for these individuals?
Yes, Your Honor. They were given Italian counsel for the Italian criminal proceeding. And they also had American counsel, and that was for the CIB proceeding. Along with Smith, okay. I think...
Counsel, let me ask one question before you leave. As I understand it, appellant would concede that if he was found guilty as charged, he was on adequate notice, that if they proved his conduct, it was prejudicial to Garland. I mean, they proved it was 133, discrediting an officer and a gentleman. What are we supposed to decide?
Your Honor,
Either what they alleged was an offense under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, and the facts are there, or it's not an offense.
Yes, Your Honor.
And you concede that if it's under 134, then it's properly included under 133.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think under properly included in 133, with all the elements that are included within that offense. Judge Cox,
In 133, would it make any difference that this was a criminal proceeding, back to Judge Stuckey's question? I mean, if he was doing it to impede the CIB, wouldn't that be conduct unbecoming an officer?
It would be if they charged 96A under the, which is the impeding an administrative proceeding. However, they did not. They charged it as an obstruction of justice.
Didn't we say in 40 that it doesn't have to be a crime at all? It doesn't have to be an enumerated offense at all?
Perhaps, but what we have here is an enumerated
perhaps.
Offense.
We did say that in Forney.
We did say that, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
But right, what we have is...
No, but it goes to Judge Cox's question.
Yes, Your Honor, but what they were put on notice of is actual elements of an actual...
Right, but you could construct a spec that said he did this and it was conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman. End of story.
Yes, they could have done that.
Okay. They didn't do it.
They did not do it, yes.
But I think that goes to Judge Cox's point.
Absolutely. They could do that, but they did not do that.
Okay.
Yes, sir. As far as support for why foreign criminal proceedings should be excluded, we look at historic history, and we also look at the plain language of the of Article or Paragraph 96 of Part 4 of Manual for Court Martial. And in the history, if we look to the analysis of the punitive articles in Appendix 23, we have two sources for two sources for why this became an enumerated Article 134 offense, and that's United States versus Favors, and it also mentions the 18 U.S.C. code provisions. The 18 U.S.C. code provisions specifically talk about obstruction of federal criminal proceedings, so it's limited to a certain proceeding which it deals with. And then United States versus Favors, a major quote in that is from United States versus Long, talking about what obstruction of justice in the military system is about. And it says, the essence of the offense denounced is the obstruction or interference with the administration of justice in the military system. And that's what we're talking about, the administration of justice, the administration of justice in the military system.
Take me back to the Smith case again and tell me how that works.
United States versus Smith, there was a parallel investigation going on by the military.
But which one was obstructed?
The state proceeding was obstructed.
And they found that was sufficient?
Yes, because they knew that because he knew an investigation was going forward in the military side, this would necessarily lead to that.
And they knew there was an investigation going forward on the military side here?
In our case?
Yes.
Yes, they knew a CIB was going on.
Brings me back to my earlier question, the rationality and supposition that with 20 dead people, you're only going to get an accident board.
Yes, sir, and that's our contention.
Thank you very much.
Welcome. Along with Smith, I think the concurrence by Judge Cox made a point about the fact that there are no strictures within the actual paragraph 96 that make reference that somehow a state proceeding would be excluded from this thing. We have those strictures in this case. If we look to the Article 134, paragraph 96, we have those strictures. In this case, that we wouldn't necessarily have in a state case. We have, within the explanation portion, it talks about something relating to a violation of a criminal statute of the United States to a person authorized by a department, agency, or armed force of the United States. So under the explanation portion, which is by the precedent, which who also made 134 this obstructing justice, one of the delineated 134 offenses.
But haven't we held that those examples in the explanation are illustrative rather than exclusive?
Your Honor, I think they probably maybe are illustrative. But I think the way that it's written, it seems to indicate that that's the intent, is we're talking about a United States criminal violation here.
You're talking about dual sovereigns, state, federal, Italy federal.
As long as it affects the military criminal system, yes. I think that's what they're talking about. I think the bench book even has that language in it, the military judge's bench book. Notably, 10 years ago, the military judge had to add a paragraph to his instructions beyond the bench book, adding this foreign criminal jurisdiction and creating an own paragraph. Now, 10 years later, we still don't have that paragraph in the bench book, so it's still not recognized.
Consul, I don't want to belabor this because your time is running short, but how do you then address the military judge's instruction that he informed the parties he was going to give? Therefore, the term criminal proceedings also includes obstruction of a foreign criminal proceeding or investigation when such obstruction of the foreign criminal proceedings or investigations have a direct impact on the effectiveness of the military criminal justice system by being directly prejudicial to good order and discipline in the armed forces or being directly discreditable to the armed forces.
Yes, Your Honor.
Doesn't that tie that into the military?
Well, I think what they have to do is explain that this theory of the SOFA agreement being a conduit in order for the members to really understand it, to tie it actually to the criminal proceedings. What I read this to mean is the military members are allowed, if they find that they obstructed, they knew a foreign criminal proceeding was occurring, and they obstructed that foreign criminal proceeding, that was enough to find them guilty of obstruction of justice. That's the way I read that. The prejudicial good order and discipline, that's just another element that they would have had to find.
Do you concede that they obstructed the foreign proceeding?
No, Your Honor, I don't concede that. I'm sorry. If the facts were found, the obstruction of criminal proceedings, I don't think that would have been met in this case.
Okay, you better move on to some of your other arguments.
Your Honor, just to briefly touch upon the UCI and the accuser issue. This is a very large case, the most international case that we have probably seen. We have 20, we have 20 people who have died from this internationally. And we have everybody's hands in the pot about what to do about this. General Pace actually took this away from General Ryan to be the convening authority for this CIB. He sent it to a CIB, he named his deputy as the president of that CIB, and he had daily contact with that deputy, General DeLong.
Isn't this an administrative proceeding? Everything you complain of has to do with safety board.
It is an administrative proceeding, but...
Right, and everything in it is inadmissible in a court-martial.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so where's the UCI as it relates to a court-martial?
Well, this is the seed that grew to the criminal investigation, and it's through the CIB where you see the fact that this court, this had to go to court-martial. That's a quote from Don Rainey, the ex-wife of one of the backseaters who talked to General Krulak, and he said, why this didn't go to an A&B, just an A&B, this has got to go to a court. And we have that,
Counsel, one interesting fact. Assume arguendo that there was unlawful command influence. How would you explain he was found not guilty?
Not guilty, the first one? Well, because he was not guilty.
you would logically think if somebody's trying to influence it, they'd find him guilty.
Yes, Your Honor, but the fact that this secondary charge, this obstruction of justice, this second court-martial went forward.
Who convened it? I forget.
General Pace convened it as well.
Wasn't it convened separately because the accused would not consent to joinder?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
That's correct, Your Honor. However,
Isn't it a bit attenuated? The second charge isn't the charge we have here, isn't it attenuated? Isn't the conduct of which you complain directly related to the charges upon which the appellant was acquitted?
No, Your Honor, it is, Your Honor, in one sense. However, this obstruction of justice, the fact that this had to go to court-martial, the fact that this was a political tragedy, the fact that we had, after this acquittal, we had the Secretary of Defense talking to the Minister of Defense of Italy and saying, and assuring him there was another court-martial after this.
Well, did the CIB even deal with these obstruction charges? Were they even aware of that allegation?
No, Your Honor, they were not. No, Your Honor, they were not.
And so I guess my question is the same. I mean, obviously your arguments all appear to go to the charges that were tried at the first trial. Unless you're arguing that there was some kind of overwhelming animus that just kind of flowed on from the first trial into the second.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's the gist of my argument, that there is this overall belief that in order for justice to prevail, somebody has to be court-martialed, somebody has to be convicted.
And what is the evidence that you rely on to prove that?
It's all apparent unlawful command influence. After this acquittal, we had the Secretary of Defense talking to the Minister of Defense. After a closed-door meeting with the President during that very day.
Well, now, what do you do with the factual findings of the military judge at the first trial that were adopted by the military judge at the second trial and adopted by the CCA that appear to certainly conflict with that interpretation?
I think those are problematic in themselves.
Are they clearly erroneous?
Yes, Your Honor. It completely dismisses Colonel Blitzendorfer and his testimony. And his testimony went...
He was on the CIB, was he not? Well, he was not a member of the court martial. It all goes to the CIB, does it not?
I think that's where it starts, Your Honor. But I think that's where you see where the pushing for this to go to court martial exists.
Well, no, it's pushing. At most, Blitzendorfer is pushing to get a particular result out of a safety board, which is an administrative body whose all evidence before which is not admissible in a court martial.
I think Colonel Blitzendorfer was looking for a fair result. General DeLong's interpretation was that he was looking for a certain result. I think the CIB is very important, and I don't think it can be dismissed because it's administrative. We had the Commandant talking to the CIB, making recommendations. We had General Clark making recommendations and being incorporated.
Okay, you got a CIB. You got some quantum of action with respect to an administrative board which isn't included in the definition of UCI. Thereafter, you have an acquittal. And then finally, you've got the instant case. Where's your prejudice?
Your Honor, this should not have gone to a court-martial. It was requested...
Okay, so we're back to 20 dead people, and you're saying Article 15 is good enough for 20 dead people?
Your Honor, 20 dead people had nothing to do with an obstruction of justice charge. And that's exactly what people believed was going on. You're going to a court-martial because 20 dead people are...
Mm-hmm.
There are 20 dead people.
Well, but you've already been acquitted of the charges relevant to 20 dead people.
Exactly, Your Honor.
Okay.
And therefore, this court-martial...
So where's the prejudice?
The fact that they actually went to court-martial for an obstruction of justice charge when there was nothing on the tape, and they requested that this go to NJP. Other people had gone to NJP for similar actions. And the fact that we have this taint throughout the higher echelons of the Marine Corps and the departments and the President, not necessarily the President of the United States, the Prime Minister, talking about these things and pushing this to another court.
Does diplomacy constitute UCI?
Your Honor, it could if it affects the court-martial and the court-martial process. And that's our argument.
That's a pretty broad definition.
Well, I think it can be directed. Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time. Could I finish?
You can finish answering the question.
I think it can be a broad definition. But what you need to do is focus on the facts of what happened. And if international pressure somehow affects this court-martial, that's unlawful command influence.
No. UCI has to be committed by a person subject to the code.
But if the
international pressure by the President or the Prime Minister of Italy, neither one of whom are subject to the code, cannot be UCI.
No, but the people who direct that a court-martial exists.
Well, then you've got to prove some cause and effect relationship.
Well, that's what this unlawful command influence is. I mean, that's what the appearance is in this case. The fact that we have a Secretary of Defense, the fact that we have the Prime Minister standing right next to the President talking about a future court-martial and that justice will prevail. All those things go to show that there was not an option here, that the people who convened this second court-martial were going to go forward with it.
Thank you.
Thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Government?
Good morning, Judge Erdman. May it please the Court. The government agrees with appellant that the two main issues animating this appeal are the legality and legal sufficiency of the Article 133 charges at issue, as well as the potential command influence issues. Looking first to the underlying legality of the charge, which goes to the foreign criminal proceedings and whether the judge appropriately instructed, he did so. This Court's case law, particularly United States v. Smith, recognizes that what most animates the Article 134 obstruction of justice charge is the recognized impact of the service member's conduct on the military and its mission.
But would you address Judge Cox's question as to whether they were on notice that destruction of evidence as opposed to some other action constituted obstruction of justice?
Yes, I would like to touch upon that as well. First, under Article 133, whether they were on notice that their conduct was criminal, first, they were on notice that 134 contemplates obstruction of justice. And I believe this was not fully briefed. We'd be happy to submit a supplemental brief. But certainly, destruction of evidence, even if it's something that is the personal property of a person, can be obstruction of justice, so long as the requisite intent exists.
I'll be candid with you. I looked and had others look. I hadn't found a reported case in 59 years under the UCMJ where destruction of evidence constituted obstruction of justice. People have erased computers, have computer files, would that be obstruction of justice?
I believe it could be, yes, Your Honor, if the intent there is to impede.
No one's been prosecuted, have they? Where would Captain Asbury know that destroying that tape could subject him to liability under the Uniform Code of Military Justice? If you go all the way back to when I first came on this court, the Air Force said that an officer was not on notice that his conduct was fraternization because it was not against the customs of the service. Where would Asbury go to find that if I destroy these? He goes to the JAG. I want to destroy this tape, sir. And you say, well, under provision XYZ, you cannot. Where would he find that?
Just in isolation, absent the mishap, he could certainly destroy the tape, and there's certainly no crime. He can always dispose of his own property as he sees fit. However, an obstruction of justice charge, and the Court has previously noted that it can be difficult to draw the line where obstruction of justice exists, and that the ultimate test is on a case-by-case basis. And looking at this case, we have to take the other facts into account. And the most obvious one is that he was just involved in an aircraft mishap where he knew he collided with a cable connected to a gondola. By that very same evening, he knew people had died. And he knew he had damaged a military aircraft. He knew he had operated that aircraft outside the altitude limitations of the route. And he knew, as he said to Major Gross in the control tower just minutes after landing the airplane, we're going to get drilled really hard. He knew they were in trouble. And in that context, hiding the tape, which certainly he and Captain Schweitzer believed was incriminating, that was the two crew members in the rear cockpit. Their motivation was to get out of the airplane, and they did so quickly that one of them broke his foot. Captain Ashby and Captain Schweitzer remained in the cockpit to ensure that they got that videotape and that the videotape did not immediately fall into the hands of investigators.
What would your position on this issue be if we were to hold that a foreign criminal proceeding is not included in the obstruction of justice offense?
In that event, a judge's erroneous instruction is still tested for prejudice, and this court has to be convinced that that the verdict was still valid even with that erroneous instruction. And the government believes, given the weight of the evidence here, that even with that erroneous instruction, the court can be satisfied beyond a reasonable doubt that the error was harmless, that the members would have convicted anyway. And what the members had to look at was, and I think what's most important, is the conduct immediately after they landed that airplane. They were concerned with getting hold of that videotape and not letting that videotape fall into the hands of any investigator. And that was before anything was instigated, because they knew that even if the actual impact with the gondola cable was not on the videotape, they knew that there was other incriminating information on there. There are other charges that one can contemplate from this episode, including damage to military property for severely damaging the airplane, as well as reckless operation of an aircraft.
The government doesn't have to be proved beyond a reasonable doubt there was anything incriminating on that tape, do they?
Absolutely not. No. All we have to show is that it
would have been of interest.
Back to Judge Erdman's question on can this court be satisfied that the verdict would have been the same without the erroneous instruction, I believe the court can, given the strength of the government's case here.
Given the way the specifications were drafted by referencing the obstruction and the conspiracy offenses, where does Conliff fit into this? The Conliff case where we held that for 133 conduct on becoming an officer, there is no need to show that the underlying conduct indeed constitutes an offense.
In that case, this court could find a lesser included offense. Here, in this particular case, the government charged it incorporating the 134 charge, and the military judge instructed the members on all of the elements.
So that sets the stage.
That sets the stage. Okay. Now, if this court would affirm on a lesser included, just saying that there was some conduct here, the secreting and ultimate destruction of a videotape, which would have been of assistance to an investigation, and that conduct was prejudicial, conduct of becoming an officer, there is more than sufficient basis for that finding. And looking to Article 133 generally, and this comes a little bit back to the notice issue, despite its broad language, one other thing we look to for notice, even if the conduct is not otherwise criminal, is customs of the service. And the non-exclusive list that's existed long in the UCMJ under Article 133 in the discussion is examples of conduct of becoming an officer, things like cheating on an exam, lying, deceit, fraudulent conduct. It's all the sort of things that impugn the integrity or the person standing as an officer, anything involving fraud or deceit. And that's what was involved here, secret and hiding.
We're making a very technical type of analysis here, but at the bottom line, as I would understand the government's position, would be that no reasonable officer, given the facts and circumstances that there were 20 civilians dead, that they had a tape that showed at least a portion of the mission underway, that the destruction of that when these investigations, whether it be criminal investigations, civil investigations or what, the destruction of that would be conduct unbecoming an officer and a gentleman.
That's correct.
You just have no right to destroy that evidence.
That's correct, Your Honor. At some point, even if it's your own property, you have a duty as an officer. You're held to very high standards to ensure that.
I assume that instead of this being a tape video camera, it was a modern one that had digital recording, you couldn't delete it either.
That would be the government's position, yes, Your Honor.
Other counsel indicated that there was an agreement with regard to what would be on that tape and what was not there. Is that correct?
He referenced page 5 of our brief, and that was a fact section of our brief where I just cited to the record that Captain Schweitzer testified that he was not using the camera. And
at the time of the mishap?
At the time of the mishap, yes, Your Honor.
And you concede that would be the case?
That's the only evidence that's there on what's on the videotape. So that's there's no other evidence, so the government would have to assume that was indeed the case. There's nobody else testified that the case.
Why would you make that assumption?
I'm sorry?
Why would you make that assumption? I mean, they destroyed the tape.
Yes, Your Honor.
Because they didn't want anybody to see what was on it. Mm-hmm. And you're now assuming that it doesn't show anything beyond what they said it showed?
The government's got no evidence in the record to rely upon other than just, well, he must have been lying because it was incriminating. Certainly there was other information on that tape that was, the government doesn't concede that the tape had no evidentiary value. Even if it was exculpatory, it had evidentiary value. And once again, going back to my comment about...
If it was exculpatory, why would it have value?
The ultimate goal of any system of justice or any investigation for that matter is to seek the truth. And any information on that tape would have provided information on how the air crew was operating the aircraft on those portions of the route where they actually videotaped their actions. If they were operating the aircraft entirely in compliance with all rules and regulations, that would certainly be exculpatory and would go to the ultimate question, as in the first trial, whether they were negligent or not. And the if it was inculpatory, it would have assisted the government. Certainly it would have been relevant evidence to prove that they were violating rules and regulations on this part of the route, and the reasonable inference is that they were doing so later on when they hit the gondola.
But there was evidence that an Italian civilian was shot with a pistol.
Yes, Your Honor.
And it came out that the appellant threw away a pistol, and he said, doesn't matter, that wasn't the pistol, the guy was shot with.
Well, in that case, there's... Well, the government never conceded
That's what I'm asking.
We just stated what the evidence was.
The government doesn't know what's on the
table. Maybe I'm digging myself in a hole where I don't have to.
That's what I was wondering.
I apologize if I left that impression.
My understanding was that you conceded it.
We were just reciting our fact section of
reason. You're saying you didn't concede it. You simply stated
he,
Schweitzer, testified to that effect.
Yes.
Okay.
Now, could the members have just completely disbelieved them and decided that they were, in fact, videotaping that part of the flight? Absolutely. But we don't know. It's a general verdict, so we don't know. Ultimately, I'd like to go back to look at a couple of the elements again. There was a lot of talk earlier about whether Captain Ashby had a subjective belief that there was going to be a criminal investigation or a criminal proceeding. The actual element just says that he had reason to believe, and the government thinks that leans more towards the objective side. It's an objective test, whether the facts would lead a reasonable person to believe. And we key in on the language that he had reason to believe that there would be an investigation. And here, to echo Judge Stookie's comments, is there was abundant reason to believe that there was ultimately going to be a United States criminal investigation, even if we were to limit it to strictly United States proceedings and not foreign proceedings. And therefore, that element is clearly met. To adopt the appellant's position that it's only his subjective belief that controls would allow anybody to escape liability merely by getting up and testifying that I had no idea and I didn't believe there was going to be a criminal investigation. And that can't possibly be the case. The jury, the members must be permitted to consider all the facts and circumstances to ultimately decide whether those facts and circumstances gave the accused a reason to believe that there would be a criminal investigation. As far as the foreign criminal proceedings here, as this court recognized in the United States v. Smith, the ultimate issue is the recognized impact upon the military and its mission, which goes to Clauses 1 and 2 of Article 134, whether it was prejudicial, good, or indiscipline, or of a nature to bring discredit upon the armed forces. The language itself in the charge is just criminal proceeding. That's nice, broad language. It's not necessarily limited to U.S. or military proceedings only. And in this particular case, judging the case on its particular facts and circumstances, clearly, even if there was only obstruction of justice with regard to the Italian proceeding, that had an effect on the military because it brought discredit upon the United States Armed Forces.
But isn't it a little bit more of a stretch to go with an Italian investigation vis-a-vis state investigation?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think in this particular case, there's even more reason to incorporate the Italian criminal investigation because you've got the status of forces agreements, you've got issues of international relations. When this case happened, there were threats. Italy was threatening to kick the United States forces out of Italy. That is a huge deal. Not only does it bring discredit upon the armed forces, it brings discredit upon the entire United States.
Well, how's that cut with UCI? If it's such a huge deal. The appellant is claiming that all this, balled up and, basically impelled this second prosecution.
I would bring the court back to the Allen elements here for unlawful command influence in the first place. First, there have to be facts that constitute UCI. Next, the proceedings had to be unfair, and the UCI caused the unfairness. With regard to the first trial, there cannot possibly be any unfairness. He was acquitted of every charge. With regard to the second trial, once again here, everything that appellant focuses on revolved around the officers involved in the original investigation board, which had nothing to do. They were ignorant of the fact that the tapes had been substituted. That fact had not come to light until many months after the mishap. In fact, the obstruction of justice charges at issue here were not even brought until 5 months after the original charges. So the Article 32 was done. Everything was done except for the trial. And the only reason there was a separate trial is because appellant, as is his absolute right, refused joinder.
Can I bring you back for just a minute to the obstruction?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is it the government's position that any obstruction of the investigation of a crime against the Italian criminal code or against the in violation of the Italian criminal code, any obstruction of that by a United States officer would qualify for a violation of the Code of Military Justice?
Not necessarily, because ultimately it has to be brought back to quote the Smith case again, the recognized impact of that service member's conduct upon the military and its mission. So if it's just a traffic offense, a speeding ticket, and he somehow obstructs justice there, whether that has any impact whatsoever on
good order discipline. Any serious crime?
Yes, I think it would, but it would still be, I think, ultimately judged on a case-by-case basis. It can't
even if it didn't involve flying a military aircraft or using military means or related to a military mission, but was rather a crime arising out of a firefight.
And once again, I think the ultimate question would be, did it impact the military and its mission? And that would depend on the particular facts and circumstances of each case. I don't think you can make a bright-line rule as to misdemeanors no, felonies yes, or some line like that. With regard to a bar fight, there was a case, not cited in my brief, but cited by the lower court, United States v. Finsel, which arose out of the loss of a pistol in a bar in Panama. And the accused in that case staged a firefight by shooting his M16 in the air and causing a commotion to cover up the loss of the pistol. And that was a guilty plea, but this court did say that loss of a weapon under these circumstances in a combat environment while the appellant was in violation of a command policy had the potential to affect the brigade's performance of his military mission. And that's what hooked it in to Article 134 and how this court affirmed the guilty finding. And I think this case is involves an officer as opposed to an enlisted man, but it's very analogous. You have the pilot in this case, that was operating an aircraft outside the route, hit a gondola cable, and severely damaged the aircraft as well as killing 20 people. And those circumstances certainly affected the squadron's ability to perform its military mission. One aircraft was taken out of commission and impacted the military's ability to conduct its mission. And
but that goes to the charges at the first trial. And we're talking about the obstruction charges here. So how do you tie those two together?
Finsel was an obstruction of justice case, Your Honor. And that was what the court keyed upon was this did, even though at the moment he covered up his loss of the pistol, there was no investigation pending, that he knew that losing a pistol in that situation would likely, or he had reason to know that it would trigger a criminal investigation, which is why he attempted to cover up his loss of the pistol. And the same thing here. At the moment the collision, they knew they damaged an airplane, they knew they'd hit a gondola, they sought to hide the videotape. They knew there was going to be an investigation, and they had reason to believe that there would be a criminal investigation before, certainly at some point before they ultimately destroyed the videotape. That was abundantly clear.
If we keep our eye on the fact that this is a 133 charge, because I wrestled in my mind, how would we make law that talked about foreign investigations and so forth? Because some of them may be ones that we would encourage people to impede. But the North Koreans wanted to investigate somebody crossing the 38th parallel or something.
Yes, Your Honor.
So it has to go to conduct unbecoming an officer.
That's
or,
correct.
Or
yes,
service
sir.
Discredit. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Could
I switch just a minute, and I don't want to dwell on this, but the Navy Court found that the delay in this case, the post-trial delay, was unreasonable, didn't they?
Yes, they did, yes, sir.
And violated principles of due process?
I believe they did make that finding. And then
focused on the prejudice side of it.
Yes, Your Honor.
Has that been a longstanding test of this court?
The due process violation from the United States v. Toohey is relatively recent, and I don't know the exact year. Toohey, I think, is in 60 MJ, so within the last 10 years. The government, in a previous case, United States v. Bush, raised the argument that perhaps it's inappropriate to create a constitutional issue based on a public perception test, and that...
In judging these post-trial delays, I noticed from the chronology that the appellant asked for 33 enlargements of time.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Over a period of almost 3 years.
That's correct.
And then again, they asked for four more enlargement of time to reply to your brief. I'm just wondering how much of the delay can be laid at the feet of an appellant.
Well, under this court's jurisprudence, United States v. Marino, all of that delay is automatically attributed to the government because the appellate defense counsel is a government employee.
I'm not familiar with the Marino decision, so that's however, why I asked the question.
Right. However, there's been a very recent United States Supreme Court case, Vermont v. Brillen, that came out just within the last 6 months, and in fact came out after the lower court's decision in this case. And that court addressed post-trial delay, where the delay is caused by a public defender. And the court said that that delay, rather than being attributable to the government, is attributable to the appellant himself.
But didn't they also say in that case that that would not be the situation if there was a systemic problem within the public defender's office? And didn't this court rule in one of its earlier cases that the Navy Marine Corps system had a systemic problem in delay?
Yes, Your Honor, we agree that that was an exception that the Brillen Court recognized. Whether or not there was a systemic breakdown, the lower court didn't make any findings. With regard to this case, the lower court didn't make any findings.
I can't remember the name of that case, and it might have been Marino, I'm not sure. But at that point, this court found that there was a systemic problem. There may not be now, but I mean, that's the status of the law, I think.
And if the court wanted to dig into that issue a little bit deeper, perhaps that would be appropriate for the lower court to take another look at, or perhaps a debate hearing. But
there has
been a change in the law a bit.
I guess what I'm interested in, under what circumstances do you give relief? Because of prejudice by the delay, I mean, what if he were to prevail here at this court and everything got set aside? All the prejudice he's complaining about is still there, isn't it?
Well, nothing can be undone about the delay itself. However, the government has proposed in our brief here, as well as in the Bush case, that the only issue of prejudice that should be looked at least as of constitutional magnitude, is as recognized in Parker v. Wingo, the constitutionally cognizable anxiety, the impairment on retrial, or the impressive incarceration, none of which exist in this case.
In your opinion, we have met the standard in Allende?
I'm sorry, I was going to say?
The standard in Allende for showing prejudice.
The appellant has not met that here. And he's got an initial burden of production, and he has failed to show any specific prejudice, nothing but speculation. And therefore, the lower court appropriately, under this court's existing case law, found that the prejudice was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or the delay was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And
let me just ask you about the CCA. Did the CCA ultimately simply find a Toohey-type violation?
I believe that was the case. I'd have to look one more time. But they did find that there was undue delay in this case.
Well, there was undue delay, but it was a Toohey-type situation.
That's correct.
Situation.
I believe so, yes.
Okay.
Right. And that was in their second opinion after the after the court order. Subsequent CA's action.
Reading from the decision, it says, though we can discern no particular Barker prejudice in this case, we find a due process violation resulting from our balancing of the other three factors, as the delay in this case is, quote, so egregious that tolerating it would adversely affect the public's perception of the fairness and integrity of the military justice system.
Yes, sir, and that would be the Toohey.
Yeah.
So, yes, that was a Toohey violation. But the lower court also correctly determined that there was no prejudice and that the error was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Returning once again very briefly to the command influence, both the military judge and the lower court correctly decided that there was no unlawful command influence that influenced either the first court or this current court. And this, the obstruction of justice charges, because they were not discovered until after the command investigation board was long complete, the government proposes or suggests that anything that happened there is completely irrelevant to the question of unlawful command influence in this present case before the court. And that, so the focus is a little bit more on the accuser. And the problem with this case is it was such a big case that no matter who the convening authority was, that convening authority, as an official matter, was going to have a lot of interest in this case. It's plainly apparent from the record that people in the highest levels of the United States government, from the president on down, were intimately interested in this case because of its effect relations with the Italians. And so General Pace was, as an official matter, having to deal with communications up the chain of command as well as down. And it was part of his official duties. He was pretty much compelled to communicate with the Command Investigation Board. What appellant seems to be proposing here is that one of two things. Either whenever there's a big, heavy case, the military justice system is simply incapable of handling it because commanders will get too intertwined, even if that interaction is as a purely official matter. And that can't possibly be the case. That's what commanders are supposed to do.
Well, you know, I think Judge Stuckey asked a question. As I understand the chronology here, he was charged with the obstruction along with the other negligent homicide. It was added. It was an added charge.
Is that correct? Yes, sir. The government didn't discover that for several months until...
But follow me. It was added in his original court-martial.
That's correct,
and
Your
Honor. He objected to that joinder.
That's correct.
So any suggestion that the commanding general decided to go forward with the second set of charges because he was acquitted is pretty much...
That's
assumed. It was already, he made that decision before.
That's correct, Your Honor.
It's not like, well, he got away, so let's find something else.
That is correct,
Your Honor. Have that.
The government had they wanted to join the charges at the original trial, and the accused objected. So any suggestion that these charges were brought just to get him is, I think, completely unfounded. As far as General Pace having a personal interest, no, he had an official interest. All of his actions are explained by his official duties, and that's what a convening authority is supposed to do. If there's something that might lead to criminal charges, the convening authority is supposed to order an investigation, which is exactly what General Pace did. He is supposed to communicate with his SJA and his legal staff about charges, Article 6B. That's exactly what he did when he talked to the Legal Support Services Division in Lejeune. That's what convening authorities are supposed to do. And under the facts and circumstances of this case, there's absolutely no indication that General Pace was either an accuser or that there was any unlawful at all.
And one last question before we run out of time. What was the legal and logical relevance of the victim impact testimony in this case? That was unusual.
What the military judge, I think, referred to was the lingering questions that the family members had. He engaged on the record in a very detailed analysis under RCM 1001b4, as well as conducting a balancing test on the record under 403 to ensure. And there was a lot of stuff that he said more prejudicial and probative, and very narrowly constrained what the trial counsel could ask, practically scripting the questions. That's all you can ask, nothing more. So each witness was up on the stand for only a minute or two. And under those circumstances, the military judge, he's tested for abuse of discretion. He did not abuse his discretion in allowing that very limited testimony on the record.
And what was the point of that testimony?
Merely to establish that the effect of the appellant's misconduct on the relatives of the victims was that it left them with lingering questions, and they had unanswered questions about how their family members...
Of not knowing what was on the tape.
Not knowing what was on the tape. And it was very, very limited. And it's apparent from reading through the judge's and that's at Joint Appendix page 547 to 548. Very limited instructions, and even after the family members testified, he gave the members another limiting instruction, cautioning them to that they could only use that for the limited purpose that he had permitted. In that situation, he did not abuse his discretion.
But each one of those witnesses talked about how devastated they were as a result of the family members and so forth. Yes?
I believe so, yes, sir.
Yes. And so the impact had to do with the death of these individuals, and there had been an acquittal with regard to this.
The overall, the government maintains that military judge's limiting instructions, the questions he permitted to be asked, were sufficient to bring the actual testimony of the members gave within the ambit of 1,000 RCM or MRE, and that he did not abuse his discretion in permitting that testimony. Everybody knew that the family members had died. That was the members knew it. There was no issue. That was very clear. And the judge gave numerous instructions that they were not to consider the fact that people had been killed.
Yeah, I guess I just now thought of this, but is it if you obstruct a misdemeanor, is that a mitigating circumstance? And if you obstruct a felony, is that an aggravating circumstance? Or you know,
I don't know if that was ever pondered. It would
be interesting how the federal sentencing guidelines would treat that.
Yes, Your Honor. In any case, the government requests this court affirm the findings as approved below. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the appellant have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Initially, I'd just like to talk about the subterfuge evidence in sentencing. This was the members, family members of the people who had died in that tragic accident, testifying specifically to their suffering. Not suffering because the videotape was gone, but suffering because their family members were gone. That is their exact quotes. Suffering, I've lost everyone. That's what they talked about. And no limiting instruction could fix that to the members, cure that to the members. Therefore, I do believe that was an abuse of discretion for the military judge to allow that in when he knew under 403 this was going to be waving the bloody flag. Even with limitations that were overtaken by what the trial counsel asked, he asked them their age and what they did. And it was more than what the judge allowed.
Had it been limited just to the impact of not knowing what was on the tape, would that have been appropriate evidence and aggravation?
No, Your Honor. I think that under the 403 analysis, it still is too much because of the fact that it's going to come out that these people, what you're having is the victims of something they were acquitted of, or the family members of the victims who died, testifying basically that they lost all loved ones. No matter how you massage it, that's the way it's going to look, and that's the way it did come out. Next, I'd like to address post-trial delay in this case. Appellant does believe that there is prejudice in this case. So the Barker v. Wingo fourth factor test is met in this case. He had a letter from Downrange G2 Solutions that's at the Joint Appendix at page 36 in his clemency report. His clemency report requested clemency because of the fact that he is having problems because of the fact that there was such post-trial delay in this case.
Would the letter have met the criteria in Allende?
I believe it does. And if it does,
was it a job offer?
It was a job offer. I mean, it basically says, to be frank, only drawback I can see is that you are unable to travel and will find it difficult to obtain government security clearance. These are two requirements that are absolute necessity for our positions. And then at the end, in closing, I hope we will have you on board soon. So it is talking about a prospective job offer, and he's saying you can't have this job right now because the Marine Corps order doesn't allow you to travel overseas.
Well, what about the security clearance? I mean, what does the delay have to do with the fact that if a person is, and if in fact he gets, this is affirmed?
I don't know how that will affect his security clearance.
Isn't that a collateral consequence?
His security clearance?
Yeah.
Yes, but that's one of the factors that this employer looks at. The fact that he can't travel and is the other factor he's looking at. And he can't travel because for the past 10 years he's been under this appellate process, and the Marine Corps order doesn't allow him to. So I think we have met that fact. I think TUI, in general, should be looked at as the generalized due process concern because of the fact that we have over 10 years. And I don't think this should be attributed to the defense in this case. Well, there were many enlargements. A lot of those enlargements talked about the great caseloads and the fact that they had just received the case because of the turnover. This was a systemic breakdown of the public defender system as we had it in Vermont versus Brilliant. And that's what we have here, and that's what Moreno acknowledged, that there is a problem here. There is a systemic breakdown. Therefore, I think under Barker versus Wingo, under TUI, however you crack it, I think the post-trial due process concerns in this case are great, and I believe that with that regard, this case should be set aside.
Okay. Thank you, counsel. The court would like to thank counsel for both parties. This court will be in recess until 1:30.